So thank you, Sandy, for presenting on what would serve as a good introduction to what I'd like to discuss, which is adolescent sexual and reproductive health programs in humanitarian settings. Oh, just by way of background, I work at the Women's Refugee Commission's reproductive health program, and I've been here or at the Women's Refugee Commission for 7 years, and I have nothing to disclose. So as context, globally there are 16 million girls aged 15 and 19 years and 2 million girls under age 15 that give birth every year. And the risk of pregnancy-related death is twice as high for girls aged 15 and 19, but 5 times higher for girls aged 10 to 14 compared to women in their 20s. However, in humanitarian settings, childbearing risks are compounded for adolescents due to lack of access to information and services, higher risks of sexual violence, etc. At the same time, adolescents in humanitarian settings will have similar needs and desires for sexual and reproductive health information and services as their peers in non-humanitarian contexts. So as Sandy mentioned, from the following family planning statement that was developed by the Interagency Working Group on Reproductive Health and Crises, and then the multi-country baseline studies that Sandy just presented on, we learn that adolescent access to family planning services is a gap in many of these refugee or other displacement contexts. However, there is plenty of programming guidance available that has been developed from the Interagency Working Group on Reproductive Health and Crises. So it's not of the paucity of tools out there that's the issue, but it's lack of implementation. However, we've heard from practitioners in humanitarian settings that despite these tools, they don't know what to use because there's so many, or what has been proven better or more user-friendly. So we set out to do some more research on what would work. So what we ended up doing was partnering with Save the Children and UNHCR and UNFPA in 2012 to first map existing adolescent sexual and reproductive health programs in humanitarian settings, and then document effective practices for delivery of these services that include family planning to adolescents 10 to 19 in humanitarian settings. So this consisted of mapping existing programs and then documenting case studies. And for us, humanitarian settings was defined as a setting affected by conflict or natural disaster that overwhelmed existing capacity since 2009. So our cutoff point was 2009 through 2012. So for our program mapping, we sent an online survey among key networks in English and French from March through August 2012 to capture existing programs for adolescents 10 to 19. We also, in the survey, we asked a series of questions for participants to provide information on other programs they knew of so we could reach out to them to collect more information on their existence, but actually to make sure that these programs were included. We further reviewed the health sector flash and consolidated appeals proposals that are implemented or launched in new emergencies or recurring emergencies that discuss what agencies will implement what types of projects to see if we can capture programs from that route. And we reviewed programs or proposals from 2009 through October 2012. So in other words, we did quite a lot of outreach to see if we can capture even the smallest CBO programs. And the inclusion criteria for the program mapping consisted of the project having to be implemented in a crisis-effective setting at large, including post-conflict settings. Initially, our window was very narrow. We wanted it to be an acute emergency, but we realized we couldn't capture any programs that way, and therefore we expanded our definition to be crisis-effective settings at large. We wanted to make sure the programs targeted the 10 to 19 age group, so somewhere in that age range, not 20 and above. And if it was not a dedicated adolescent SRH program, then the program had to have targeted adolescents as part of a broader SRH program. So in terms of our findings, our survey reached roughly 1,200 individuals through listservs, and based on more than 200 responses, a mere 37 programs focused on the SRH needs of 10 to 19-year-olds since 2009. So this is very small. And among the 37 programs, when we looked deeper, only 21 offered at least 2 methods of contraception, and none were in acute onset emergency settings. In terms of our funding analysis, we reviewed a total of 2,638 health proposals that were launched in various humanitarian appeals from 2009, so 101 appeals, and only 37 again included some element of ASRE. So how we did this was a keyword search for key terms that we thought were would be included in health proposals that pertain to adolescent reproductive health, and then we delved deeper into what were these programs about if they address this age range. And what we also looked at how much of these, how many of these appeals were funded. And among the 37 programs, only 32% received any funding. So 7 programs are fully funded and 5 were partially funded. So among the whole pool of health proposals, only 3.5% of these had any mention of adolescent sexual and reproductive health. And then again, the majority went unfunded. So in terms of the good practices, despite the dire status of the lack of programs, we did find some groups doing very innovative work. To be selected as a good practice, the programs had to have offered at least 2 methods of modern contraception and had to have demonstrated increased contraceptive uptake. And we use this as a marker of effectiveness given the importance of pregnancy prevention in adolescent lives. We wanted to make sure that this component was included in the program. And the programs, 3 programs we selected that we actually visited to assess why these programs were effective. One was the Adolescent Reproductive Health Network in Thailand, who our colleague Meredith Walsh, unfortunately she's not here today, but she was instrumental in establishing this youth center-based program that's run by a community-based organization network of 8 CBOs that serve the Burmese migrants that come from the border area. The second program we evaluated was Pro Familia's project in Pacific Coast Colombia, where they serve the internally displaced populations there. And the third program was Straight Talk Foundation's very innovative youth center in Gulu, northern Uganda. And while this is a post-conflict setting, they had established or begun implementing services from the height of the emergency in the early 2000s that we included this as part of our scope. And other notable programs, while these weren't as we couldn't find as much information about their effectiveness as these 3 that we examined. There were 4 that we picked up for their unique models and approaches that we thought could be promising. One was the Haiti Adolescent Girls Network, which I see loves here, and it's very wonderful to see. They have a strong network model of different agencies, not just working in health, but in various sectors that try to look at adolescents holistically. And then the American Refugee Committee's program in Rwanda in Gahimba Camp, which is a school-based program for adolescents. And Family Health Options in Kenya, they operate a very comprehensive program in the Somali slums in Eastleigh, Nairobi. So that was the urban program that we wanted to highlight. And then UNFPA developed a humanitarian consortium in the Philippines in advance of these cyclical natural disasters that were occurring in that region. And this was to look at how to integrate adolescents in their disaster risk reduction preparedness efforts to make sure that adolescents weren't forgotten. So findings from these good practices. We learned that successful programs have ensured stakeholder involvement to build community trust and secure adult support. This is quite critical, and we know this from development settings as well. But again, it was reinforced in these programs in humanitarian settings. We also saw that adolescent participation and engagement was quite critical. And beyond the tokenistic, we spoke with X people, but making sure that they were actually involved in decision making, in the assessment, design, implementation, monitoring, evaluation, in all phases. Successful ASRH programs were also responsive to the different needs of adolescent subpopulations. So one thing we did find was a lot of programs tended to look at adolescents as a homogenous group when we know they aren't. There are, especially in crisis settings, married adolescents, pregnant adolescents, adolescents in school, adolescents out of school, disabled adolescents. So looking at these the unique needs of subgroups was something that these good programs were actually doing. Successful programs also had qualified and dedicated ASRH staff, including clinical staff, which were key for the provision of health services. And many of these were providing comprehensive services at one site, so adolescents didn't have to keep going to different places for different services. Further, stronger programs took a holistic, multi-sectoral approach to ASRH. So they weren't just looking at health. They were looking at livelihoods, at protection, at education. So really making it a holistic approach for adolescents. And further, stronger programs provided refresher training, structured supervision, recognition, and ongoing mentorship to peer educators, which we know can be quite challenging to retain in these settings. and programs also offer flexible outreach strategies. So knowing that security is going to be a constraint or insecurity is going to be a constraint, how can programs really adapt to this? And one method was to really have a budget for transportation for adolescents. And then again, as the UNFPA project showed, addressing ASOH during emergency preparedness to make sure that adolescent needs are not overlooked. So what do all of these findings mean? Given the lack or paucity of available programs, we couldn't come up with a prescriptive conclusion on what we need to have a program effective. That was what we intended to come up with, but we realized that we couldn't say that. However, as I just presented in terms of the findings, there are common principles that underlie notable programs that we know have been documented as good practice even from development settings. The other issue, though, that we noted was that limited SRH supplies, especially contraceptives, as well as donor influence shift in program priorities impact the provision of SRH services. And we really saw this in terms of attention to family planning, and then suddenly it went to HIV and back and forth, et cetera. So we see an urgent need to scale up ASRH services in humanitarian settings. So in terms of recommendations, we have it more detailed in our report that is available online, but really addressing ASRH from the onset of an emergency as part of the minimum initial service package for reproductive health, which is the international standard of care to be applied at the onset of every new emergency. We also want donors to fund multi-year holistic comprehensive programs so that programs can be flexible for their iterative processes to make the improvements that need to be made for effectiveness. And then again, strengthening the capacity of development programs to be able to address ASRH as part of their emergency preparedness and response. We have some recommendations for the health cluster and sector and to mainstream adolescents, make sure that it's included as part of the appeals processes and coordination. And then for humanitarian organizations, again, for the implementation part, to make sure adolescents are included in whatever they're already doing, following guidance that have been established by the Interagency Working Group on Reproductive Health and Crises, and at the same time evolve stakeholders, strengthen linkages and referral pathways, and make sure they collect sex and age disaggregated data. And development organizations, again, our pitch was to make sure that as part of disaster risk reduction strategies, to think about how to address adolescent needs before an emergency strikes. And when it does, that they coordinate with humanitarian actors that come in. Limitations I'll skip due to time constraints, but you can find them in our report. In terms of our advocacy, we launched our report. Actually, Dr. Babatunde, the head of UNFPA, launched it with us, with the Norwegian and Rwandan missions and UNHCR. So we were able to receive a lot of high-level attention to this issue, and our reports are available online and in various different languages. But what we're doing with these findings now, as I mentioned, despite the fact that we couldn't come up with prescriptive conclusions, we are piloting a small pilot project in Goma, DRC, with Save the Children, to see if we can operationalize some of these principles that we found. And our target populations are the pregnant girls and new mothers, as well as in-school adolescents 12 to 14. So following these very small groups of adolescents to see if we can see changes in their sexual and reproductive health knowledge, as well as uptake of some contraceptives. So findings will be available in early 2012. And I'd like to acknowledge at this time my colleague Jennifer Sucht, who was part of this research team, and Seema Manohar from Save the Children, as well as UNHCR and UNFPA, who have been quite helpful and very supportive of our undertaking this initiative. So thank you very much.